It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Steve Greenberg, and the topic of the day is Wow, That's a Synagogue. That's the title. And my aim is to open up a conversation. It's not to preach in any way, but to open up a conversation on the institution of the synagogue in a way to free it and liberate it. Part of the difficulty of living in any cultural language, in any world, is that what we haven't seen, we can't imagine existing. So we all become stuck. And, you know, some of that stuckness is just what it means to be a human being, but a bit of that stuckness is about limiting the opportunities in front of us. And a great deal of education is about destabilizing subjects. The problem is that the religious communities are in the business of actually strengthening certain kinds of assumptions. And so we tend to have this mismatch, that what will enliven our communities is a certain destabilizing frame, but our communities are kind of convinced that the standard is to, the tradition is to kind of hold on to the assumptions. Rabbis experience this in a number of different ways. You know that a rabbi's job is to do two things, is to disturb the comfortable and make comfortable the disturbed. Right? To comfort the people who are troubled and to trouble the people who are comfortable. It's another way to put it, right? Well, so on some level, there's a tension inside the system with how much realness, honesty, engagement, challenge is legitimate. So what I want to do is I want to put on the table, I mean, there's a whole array of challenges that we might attend to. And this could be, you know, I've done a session on leadership development with various groups in the Reform community and in the Masorti community on this question. And so what I want to do is I want to kind of segment it, because there's so much to do. I want to spend the following segments of time. I want to have 5 minutes of complaint so that we just throw up, like literally regurgitate, our trouble and frustration and confusion and whatever around the synagogue. I want to put that aside, and then what I want to do is I want to do 2 sessions that are going to take 20 minutes each, and they really ought to take an hour each or more. And the first one is going to be a question about prayer, and if we have time, the second will be dividing you up and creating fantasy synagogues, and we'll see if we have time for this. I hope we do. Okay, first, let's throw up together. There we go. Okay. And by the way, you know, usually if you were smart, you know, and you were a rabbi, you wouldn't want to start with the negative, because let's be positive. I want to start with the negative. Yeah. What's wrong?
Why is it that no matter how many people are in the shul making up the minyan, the rabbi usually insists on keeping everybody waiting until he has finished saying the Shema?
That's a monumental problem.
It shouldn't take long then.
Okay. Shema. I'm going to put it down. Shema, we'll have to know what that means. Go ahead.
But if you could keep your throw up to limited, like, you know, like, okay. 6 words. Yeah. Yes.
I can't stand about synagogues. Well, not every synagogue, but certain synagogues and certain congregations is the anoraks, the people I call the anoraks. That all they're concerned about is the actual minutiae of observance, and things have to be done in a certain way, and the rules and regulations. They're totally obsessed.
The obsessive compulsives.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, religion is a really useful tool for them, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, listen.
It works. Okay. Go ahead.
Strictures.
Rules. Now, why is that a problem? Because some people think that that's actually a good thing. Why are rules a problem? Well, who said it? Okay, why is it a problem?
I think you have one set of rules and then they find yet another way of adding more layers to what's already there, just being more retentive.
Okay, so you guys are, this could be described, minutia, obsessive compulsive rules and control could actually be not only a synagogue problem, but a larger issue of British identity. But...
I'm South African.
Okay. Yes.
Why don't Jews want to come and pray?
Okay, so it's the standard, who's not there? But of course, that will be the death of us. That question is so profoundly the wrong question, and it always ends up in the wrong place. But it is always the question we ask when we come, because where are all the people who aren't here? And of course, that's a question that can never get to the ears of anyone present, to anyone who's not there, because they're not there. So it tends to be a blind alley. Yeah.
People arriving at all times throughout the service.
How about the service is very long and repetitive?
Long, repetitive. My partner describes going to India and having to daven in the morning, and the Indian lady who cleans his room, who's quite, religious, she says to him, "Oh, you have a very long puja." So we have a very long puja. So it takes, for them it's like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and they're done, right? Yeah.
I think failure to understand what they are. Some synagogues function as a community. Some are prayer rooms, and I don't think the synagogues seem to understand what they are, and they always seem to think there's something different from what they actually function in the community. So. I'll give you two words, a misunderstanding function.
Okay, function question. I'm going to put function question.
Yeah.
That is a good one. Go ahead, yes.
Language. Why, even although we have translations on the other side of the page, people still don't properly understand the prayer. I find a lot of them, not for me because I'm lucky, but there are lots of people out there who don't understand the service or what's being said.
Okay.
Why can we not have them in English?
Okay, so I'm going to stop here for one question. One second. Synagogue life is the most infantilizing experience for most Jews. Not all. There are many Jews who go to synagogue and feel like they are at home there. For the Jews who don't come, and for many who do come, it's a profoundly infantilizing experience. What does it mean to sit in a room, to listen to a language or be forced to read a language you don't understand a single word of? To be told to stand up, sit down, to be harangued at by a person who doesn't give you an opportunity to respond back in any way, right? So, and to be cordoned off in a seat where you can barely move. And in fact, in most British synagogues, when you're davening the Amida, your legs hurt because this is pressing against that, and you can't even move, right? It's an incredibly incarcerating and infantilizing experience for an adult, right? So that whole structure, when you don't, it's like, how many people go to the opera in the room? Go to the opera? Okay. Do you like super titles?
No.
You don't like them?
I do.
I do.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So going to shul, not knowing Hebrew at all, is like going to the opera with no super titles. There's no way for you to actually learn the drama to experience what's going on. So it's very interesting to me that these are all technical matters. But I would wonder, what's rotten in Denmark is so far beyond the technical matters. And so that's what I want to get into, because I think that if we go in this direction, you could come up with other things, but in the end I'm kind of getting the feeling that you presume that synagogue is kind of the right place and we're doing the right things, we're just not doing them in the right way. But I'm going to ask really more difficult questions about the synagogue. Questions that actually ask about what's it for, and don't presume the answer is to have the prayer services that are required. So here's, firstly, this. Please share. I'm going to pass one pack out this way, one pack out this way. Maybe one pack out Okay. I just wanted to share this with you, that the early synagogue wasn't concerned about the Shema, or minutia, or rules, or times, or repetition, or function, yes. Function, yes. What the early synagogue was a very different place from the place we now call synagogue. Let's take a look. What is Jesus experiencing in Shul? Someone please read the New Testament.
And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And he went to the synagogue, as his custom was, on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read. And there was given to him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, a recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing."
Keep going. This is another the Acts on Luke.
And on the Sabbath day they went into the synagogue and sat down. After the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them, saying, "Brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say it." So Paul stood up and, motioning with his hands, said,
like a good Jew, dramatically motioning with his hands, he gets up to speak. What is happening in these synagogues?
There's a dialogue.
Yes, dialogue. What else?
Spontaneous response.
Spontaneous response. Reading of scripture. Engagement on topics. Individual expression of faith or engagement with the text or challenge or interpretation. What is going on in synagogues is much closer to a Beit Midrash than what we understand as a synagogue. The synagogue is a Greek word for the gathering of, it's a gathering space. Right? So, it's interesting, right? Our association with the synagogue is a place to do, you know, prayer, morning, you know, noon, and night. But that is not the original synagogue frame. It turns out that the bottom one is my favorite text for this. This is a text where in the second century, or it could even be in the first century, the late first century, we found a plaque that's clearly a plaque of a donor, of, you know, someone who's given money to create the synagogue. And this is what it says. "Theodotus, son of Vetinos the priest, and Archisynagogos," that means shul president, "and son of an Archisynagogos, and grandson of an Archisynagogos, built this synagogue for reading the law, studying the commandments, and as a hostel with chambers and water installations to provide for the needs of itinerants from abroad, which they," that is the synagogue, "his fathers and elders and the Simandes founded. What's the synagogue for? Two things. The study of the Torah and a hostel for travelers. Why do we say that the Kiddush and Shul on Friday night? Only one reason. There were people who were sleeping in the synagogue and eating in the synagogue. The synagogue was essentially would you call it a B&B? So there were two rules of the synagogue, and not one of them in the first and second century was prayer. It appears that during the middle of the second century, toward the end of the second century, that's when there was a kind of development of a response to the destruction that had to do with prayer, and it emerged slowly. The very first synagogue was about the study of Torah and providing us a way station for travelers. Okay? So what does this sound like? If you had to think of a biblical image, whose home would you identify with as a synagogue?
Abraham.
Yes. Abraham and Sarah run a place where we learn later that they share Torah, right? She with the women and he with the men. And what do? They run out after travelers. Right? Now, what would it mean if I would tell you that the synagogue is an institution that is born of necessity following destruction, perhaps a little bit before it, having to do with the fact that Jews Jews were now all over the place, and they needed a way to translate what was happening in the center of Jerusalem into far-flung areas in, you know, way north in Galilee, and perhaps further, you know, east in Babylon. And so they created these places where Torah was learned and where the community was took care of people traveling and needy. And later on we discovered that there were also kind of ways to take care of the poor this way as well. Okay. In other words, the reason we have our synagogues the way we have them is an accident of history. There is no, you know, in other words, put it this way. Synagogues are born of the particular needs of an age. And therefore, if our synagogue isn't accomplishing the task of actually propelling the fundamental message of the Jewish people, then it's not working. In other words, the synagogue is an empty institution in the sense that it ought to be doing what we need it to do to sustain the living engagement of the Jewish people with the covenant. Well, that's what it's for. In one moment, it needed to be a place where Jews were slowly beginning to become a kind of, you know, pan, you know, Mideast community. They needed places that were safe for them to stay, and they needed places that could house new communal institutions, and they needed to teach and to engage with the Torah. The synagogue doesn't have to look like anything, be anything other than the institution that propels and allows for the fullest expression and engagement with the Jewish idea, you know, whatever that is. So in other words, instead of thinking that the obligation is to have a synagogue, the obligation is to figure out how the covenant gets played out in this moment, build the institution that actually accomplishes it. That's what a synagogue is. It is the space that helps us accomplish certain kind of central pieces of the covenantal fantasy. Right? So the reason I teach this is because we are so locked into all this kind of thinking. Where did the chuppah come from? Who invented the chuppah? Our chuppah comes from the way priests used to, popes used to travel, particularly in Italy and in other places, who used to travel under a canopy wherever they traveled. The canopy we use was borrowed from the church. Prior to that, it was just a tent that basically first nuptials were happening. So bar mitzvah, how old is it? 600 years old, at most. And even, the last 100 or so years, it's been this wild, you know, celebratory thing in synagogues with huge, you know, expenditures. Our grandparents, most of them didn't have bar mitzvahs or bat mitzvahs at all, but bar mitzvahs even, right? That had anything to do with that. You had your first aliyah, then you were counted in the minyan, and then you sure had a kiddush.
We did.
Out of need.
Keep her a choice.
It had to do with the money.
Well, it also had to do with different notions of childhood that got born. Because at 13, when you could be welcomed into a full adult life, you know, 100 years ago, there were all kinds of places where you were needed at 13. Today, no one needs you at 13. You have to go to school at 13. So you don't feel like an adult. They needed a way to celebrate this that was not so tied to taking one's place in the adult world. Because you were formally and physically and in so many ways still a child. So they needed to replace the bar mitzvah with something else, so they made it, they took the Sweet 16 party and kind of threw it back 3 years. But my point is that we take the structures of the moment and we make them fit what we, you know, we reinvent them in our, you know, in a kind of frame that works. So I don't need to disparage what the synagogue's become. I need to say, is it still doing its job? Because the job of the synagogue is not to do what it does. That's not the job. It's to actually make Jews. To make Jews. To enliven the covenant. To take care of us, you know, in whatever ways we need. And that, if it doesn't do that, well then, A, people, the tradition doesn't get transmitted, and the institution becomes, you know, irrelevant. And for most Jews in the West, synagogues are increasingly irrelevant. They don't work as places where we engage and discover who we are as Jews. They work as places that shame us. You go to a synagogue, most Jews go to a synagogue to feel shamed. They feel shame that they're not good enough, shame they don't understand, shame that they feel kind of out of it. Now, some of them go because, despite the feeling of dislocation, they like the camaraderie, right? I don't say that. There are lots of people who do go to synagogues who find kind of the sense of belonging and friendship lovely. But is that all? Because if that's the case, anyone who's outside those friendship circles will feel even doubly excluded. I'm excluded because I don't speak the language and because I'm told to stand up and sit down and shut up and sit in a place that's uncomfortable, and no one will talk to me because they all know each other and don't know me. Now, it helps to have a community that welcomes people who are different, right? But in the end, belonging to that group is not something that your average young person is going to want to do. So here's my question. We have two challenges, and you can decide, we can divide them up in terms of size. When I do synagogue renewal work, so what I want to do is I want to actually help people. Don't get me wrong, I want to sustain the prayer service. It's not that I want to get rid of it. I just want to, I want to free ourselves from the sense that the synagogue has to actually be X, Y, and Z, or we fail. The synagogue has to be what allows for the greatest Jewish vitality imaginable. It's the institution that gives birth to rich, exciting, engaging, thoughtful, fun-loving, community-making, caretaking Jews. How do we do that? Then we don't have to worry about whether or not, you know, who gets there on time and who isn't there. If it does that work, people will find it exciting to be there. There are alternative synagogues growing up all over the U.S. that you know, you start them off with 8 people, and in 2 years there's 80. And the reason is they're meeting needs. They are actually creating community and creating Jewish experience. So here's I think I'm going to do. I'm torn because I do two things and there's not time to do both of them. So let me just figure out which one. I think I'm going to divide you into 3 groups, and you're going to figure this out on your own. Now, by the way, I'll just tell you, if you belong to a synagogue, when I've done this work in synagogues, twice a rabbi got fired. So if you want to fire your rabbi, this is a really good suggestion to offer for liberal synagogues. So I say synagogue is created in 3 ways. There are three buildings or 3 institutions in a synagogue. There's a Beit Midrash, a house of study inside the synagogue. There's a Beit Tefillah, a house of prayer inside the synagogue. And there's a Beit Knesset. So while there's one, again, not enough, here is a short description of these institutions. I'm going to explain them as we go now, but you can have this to take with you. The Beit Midrash, well, let's start with the Beit Tefillah. The Beit Tefillah is the prayer hall. It's the thing that the Christians had that when we came into the West, we actually needed to build because we could then seem like them. We were just another religious version of what they were. We tended not to build Batei Midrash independently because there was no model of Batei Midrash in the Christian world that was you know, kind of parallel to ours. So the Beit Midrash from the Occident, we never actually really built in the West. We had rabbinical schools, but the Beit Midrash as an idea, as a cultural idea, never really got a foothold in places where there were churches, but there were no houses of study that actually kind of would give us permission to build such things. The Beit Midrash, though, is probably the single most important institutional frame for the following reason. How much Hebrew do you need to know in order to study Torah?
Well,
7 to 9. If you've got an English translator.
That's correct. Now, it makes it less interesting and sometimes less deep if you don't have the Hebrew. But you know what? Can you enter into a conversation on Torah study with absolutely no Hebrew?
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah.
So on the first level, it's not alienating in that way. Secondly, the difference is that, you know, when you go to synagogue, you're asked to sit and listen. And what's great about Torah study is you get to actually offer your opinion. You're asked to think about what a text means and what it might mean to you. You personalize. That doesn't happen very often in synagogue. The Beit Midrash is incredibly adult in its frame because it addresses real human issues that adults face, and it, because of its multi-vocality, there are many voices, as opposed to a sermon which usually says, I'm the rabbi, this is what this means, Torah study actually says, let's ask questions around what this means. What do you think? So that kind of Torah study, what I would call Beit Midrash. Now, Beit Tefillah, have you ever been to a Baptist worship in a church service? Anyone here? What's it like going to, you know, a Baptist church service?
Singing.
Singing? But
vibrant.
Huh?
It's vibrant.
It's vibrant. I'm sure we're romanticizing it to them. They were probably not quite maybe...
That's the way they always do that.
But this, you know, I have gone on Sunday mornings to in Harlem, and to this great service that Reverend Butts famously conducted. And it is unbelievable. You walk out of church buzzing from the energy, from the engagement, from the excitement, from the fullness, from the breathing, from the singing, from the expressions. It's just, what would it feel like to come back from shul feeling energized, realigned, like reconnected, as if the prayer service plugged you into the energy of the cosmos and recharged you? It's not the mind that's being addressed here. It's the sense of the connection of the body and the feeling and the engagement and the attention and the openness and the, like, what, you know, what happens in those environments? How could prayer be anything, Jewish prayer, anything like that? How could it make us feel more alive than we were when we came in? Three, Beit Knesset. This is the one that's around which many people in America, by the way, all three of these right now, there are new Jewish institutions, not Reform, not Conservative, not Orthodox. Interestingly, they do not affiliate, who are growing up, that are creating new forms of prayer, meaning like traditional egalitarian places that are Orthodox, but women have aliyot and daven kabbalat Shabbat, the Shura HaShachar, the Shem Minyanim, places like in Sharon Brous's Minyan in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, which has these incredible prayer services that are kind of lay-led and was full of music, there's drumming, right? People are reinventing a way to use the prayer service in ways that are engaging and enlivening.
Okay.
And the Reconstructors are doing it, but there are Orthodox Jews that are doing it too. The Karmach Minyanim was also a way of infusing into the experience. Now, I recognize that in Britain, exactly that much expressiveness might come off as like happy clappy and not happy clappy.
It's
not
very British.
It's not very British.
English.
Scottish
is different, yeah.
Yes, that's true. But you think that you would think it's happy clappy too, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. No, I've been to services like that. I thoroughly enjoy them.
There you go. Okay, so maybe the solution is we all become Scottish here, right?
No.
No?
I don't think that's true. I think Scottish are worse than English.
Steve, you can become Scottish anytime. Okay.
The Beit Knesset I'm going to finish is, and then we're going to work on it together. The Beit Knesset is a place of gathering where we figure out how everyone feels like this is extended family, and everyone feels like this extended family cares about the community beyond the walls of the synagogue and cares about the world beyond the walls of the synagogue. Beit Knesset is the gathering together that takes care of us and through which we organize to take care of others. That is Beit Knesset. Okay. So I would like to ask you a question. If you would please allow, literally, we only have a few minutes, so I'm going to say 10 minutes. Please divide yourselves into the following groups. I want the people who want to work on the most wonderful Beit Tefillah, the most amazing Beit Tefillah here. I want people who want to work on the most wonderful Beit Knesset here. And I want people who want to work on the most amazing Beit Midrash here. And you've got 10 minutes to figure out not what, I'm now turning it around, not what's wrong. Do not talk about what's wrong. Do not talk about bringing other people in. The question about bringing other people in is deflected. The real question is, if you build it, they will come. What would you want to be at? Because if you want to be there with all your heart and soul, others will come. Rather than create this kind of sneaky, seductive way of kind of pulling people in against their will, bollocks. Instead, figure out what would make you look forward to coming to shul because of the Beit Tfilah, because of the Beit Knesset, or because of the Beit Midrash. So, Midrash, Tfilah, no. Tfilah, yes, Knesset, Midrash. You have 10 minutes. Divide up, and I'll tell you when to stop. Divide up right now. Okay. Forgive me. I know that I caught you in the middle, and the truth is you could go on for another half hour in each of these groups, and then you could present. We're going to have a couple of moments of presentation, but I wanted to get you into this page of imagining that it's actually, the synagogue is a place where you can begin to play with things that feel fixed. So, what came up in your conversation? What would the Beit Midrash or Knesset or Tfilah of your dreams look like? Anything. Go ahead. Well, just give us the best, you know, your top five.
It would be egalitarian.
Okay, it would be egalitarian for you.
Yes.
Why? That's one group who would say it's egalitarian. There's a group who wouldn't be egalitarian. Why for you would it, I mean?
So that it would be open to men who participate.
Okay, very good.
And so that
but you understand, you could have a very, one second, what is this? This group is Beit Midrash, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so your Beit Midrash would be egalitarian. Meaning what?
Anybody could come to study, no matter what their characteristics were, or also what their level of education was.
Correct. Okay, wonderful.
Everything would be provided at the
Great. Okay, in other words, it would be a Beit Midrash, whatever the Beit Midrash, by the way, you haven't told me, is it part of the service? Is it part of the Saturday thing? Is it happening another day?
Yeah, it's 24/7.
It's an institution of 24/7, right?
Yes.
But you know, the synagogue, if it's open 24/7, still people are only going to come on certain times because that's the accepted thing. The challenge of creating a space where people would really know that they could come and have something meaningful would be an issue, right? There are places where you can learn. My question is this. How can the synagogue be a place? The synagogue, not LSJS or something else, a place where learning occurs during the day. So the first thing we hear is that it's got to be kind of learning that doesn't privilege anybody. It's so important. Because all kinds of people walk in feeling that they're going to be talked down, they're going to be right. Okay. Next.
Food and drink. You've got to have people got to come in, they can eat, they can drink anytime.
Okay. So I have a friend of mine who runs a synagogue, and here's the synagogue service. She does this in a Reform congregation on Shabbos morning, where generally only if there are bar mitzvahs there's a service. And what does she do? The first hour is ask the rabbi, the second hour is the service, and the third hour is just talking about the parasha. 3 hours long, but you can come and leave whenever you like. And in the back, there's a little card that has, you know, Borei Pri Hagafen on it, so you can make kiddush at any time. There's tea, there's coffee, there's cake. Right? And she began with 8 people, and now, she 3 years later, she had 110 people, and 5 years later, she's been the original rabbi of the synagogue was kicked out, and she was put in as the end rabbi. Because she totally transformed what constitutes what Jews know in Reform congregation. The Jews became knowledgeable in ways that totally required a reconstruction of the synagogue, and that's why the old rabbi had to leave, and that's why she's in charge.
Excuse me, which congregation are you talking about?
I don't want to say because I don't want to get her in trouble.
Is this the UK or
anything? No, this is the US.
US.
Okay. Anything else about Beit Midrash?
Yeah, it would be Limud style.
Okay, good. Which means?
Which means that there's a variety of different kinds of learning that's available, again, to different
kinds
of people.
Okay, but now I'm thinking, how does that work in a synagogue? So I want to be real with you guys. But on some level, that works in Limud. Right? It works when you have a syllabus at LSJS. How do you do it on Shabbos morning? Now, I'm not going to answer that question, but do you realize I want to create a scenario where I go to another Reform synagogue, right, in Florida this time, and instead of services, there's a group that meets in the library.
They meet a half hour later, not at 9, but at 9:30, or not at 9:30, but at 10. They only study the parasha. After the study of the parasha, right, they go and join this congregation for Aleinu and for Adon Olam, and then go to Kiddush. Now, you think that's crazy, but the truth is, how many of you would prefer to do that than go to synagogue? No one in the room?
There were some groups that would do that.
The whole time together.
Yes. By the way, maybe this is a self-selecting group. Let me tell you that in many places, if there was a congregation of learners that appeared every Shabbos morning in a convivial and warm way, why wouldn't you want to do that every Shabbos morning? And now I'm not saying, by the way, ban the service, but I'm saying if that's what Jews need, why not build it, right? And increasingly, what would it mean to do that? It would mean you put your congregational service in competition with that. Then what would happen? You'd either have to improve the quality of the service, or everyone would start going to your alternative learning service and let the service go, because they just don't follow. So on some level, what it does is it could force the service to become really richer. Okay, we don't have time for...
That's quite a big conversation.
But can I just say, it was more than just sort of text study or...
Yeah.
But it would be wise, I'd suggest a limited style, you could study literature or arts or films or... Do you know what I mean? It was a, like a broader...
100%. You could do an adult study in your congregation.
Yeah.
But my thought is that while that all's all true, those tend to be things that people elect to come to or not, but it doesn't change the culture so quickly. I'm thinking about how the service on Shabbos morning or Friday night will actually be an experience of learning, rather than what you say is true too. I think that limud experience should be kind of, it should be normative, that everyone should expect to go in a Jewish community to a limud of some kind. I think it's marvelous. My question is, what can be done weekly?
Chavrucha can be done weekly.
So what would it be like for the rabbi to once a month or twice a month not give a sermon? Just say, open up the text to this page, read these two verses and ask this question, okay? And turn to people next to you and discuss for 10 minutes, and at the end we'll talk about what you thought that meant. Okay, so it happens in some congregations. Does it happen in all the congregations you're in? No. But why not?
Can I just give an example? Big Cloud Israel, lesbian gay congregation down in London. Lesbian gay friendly congregation.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes.
But what I went many years ago to a high holiday service where there was the service going on. There was Yom Kippur, as everybody would know it, going on in one room. And then there was the gathering for people who saw themselves as secular but wanted to discuss things but did not want to be part of a servicey service in the other room. And, you know, the two things happened at once, and then, you know, there was a point where everybody came together.
Lovely. Okay, we don't have time for more, but the reason I'm doing this is because to give you a sense of what's possible in thinking, we're not going to come to solutions. This is not what this is about. There's not enough time for that. But I want to expand the discourse. Like, what is thinkable? Right? So here, quickly, what's thinkable about that?
We considered ways in which we could attract Jews to come not for a service, but purely to socialize. But we could combine it in some respects with an occasion like a Hanukkah or Purim or something like that. And we could give them some entertainment, we could give them some food, we can involve the community in preparing the food, in organizing the entertainment. We could perhaps encourage people on a Sunday morning, instead of dropping off their children at the cheder and coming back at 1 o'clock, and going off and doing whatever they want to do, we could get them to stay, maybe to socialise, maybe we could have a coffee bar or something like that, where they could sit and chat, or maybe we could have a library that they could borrow books from, and so on and so forth.
100%. But it sounds were there any other ideas that were in that genre, or even more bombastic?
We spoke about possibly gyms, having a gym,
swimming pool. So these are all great things to make something else attract Jews to shul. But I'm really trying to push in a little bit different direction. What I'm trying to suggest is that there are some people who don't, who may not find prayer moving, and may not get into learning very well. But what they do get into is feeling like they're part of a congregation in two ways. One, they feel it's their communal home, they feel like it's their kind of friendship circle, and it's their place to actually impact upon the world around them. And one of the things that this congregation in LA does is offer membership that includes requirement not to attend synagogue, but requirement to attend monthly community service events shaped by the Jewish community. And that membership, you only get to kind of, you know, be part of this effort of really kind of taking your family and doing, like, work in the inner city together with your family, or work on the environment. And that becomes your Jewish worship engagement thing. And the synagogue orchestrates that with other families, and you get those things, you learn a little bit. But the real payoff of this community is the doing, and you do work in the community in really various ways. And it's a really interesting thing, is that people actually, on different frames, they will offer time. In other words, there's been a scenario where, I forget how it works, that people, some people give, I have to come back to you with this. She's worked it out where there's kind of a bank of hours that you have to swap. You have to swap. You, in other words, you don't pay dues. That is a separate fundraising effort. You pay hours. And those hours are put in the bank, and you have to figure out how to actually pick. So the reason I say this is because it's we think that we have to kind of, you know, filter this social frame around the synagogue experience. But the synagogue instead could be the frame that carries people out of shul. And it's been very, very successful in Los Angeles and in other places. Moreover, what it does, and this is for both of you, if I learn more about the prayer service, about Hebrew, about God, and I'm asked questions about meaning and purpose and goodness, I might slowly begin to find prayer, like, less offensive or difficult or challenging. And the same thing is true here. If I get excited about the Jewish vision of changing the world, I might actually find praying for their wealth and health of, or for the health of people I love, and going to shul and celebrating things, you know, with the people I care about that I've met doing social justice, I might find it a different experience. And so these may nourish the prayer service.
I have about 20 items on my list, but I don't think you want me to run through.
No, but it's just the best.
So, all right. There was a lot about singing, dancing, and togetherness, families together, children, teenagers, women, either fully mixed in or downstairs, separate, but where they can still be very involved. That was one vision. We also had the peace, quiet, maybe davening in the garden vision. It's even happening at the same time for different people. And a lot of talk about ways to get everybody up to speed with the singing and the Hebrew. So words on the screen, having a choir or not having a choir, there's some division about that. Having a learning service once a month or at the same time in a different room. Words on the screen came up a couple of times. Harmony was another one. And above all, inclusiveness, in the sense that it was really exciting for everybody.
Interesting, the words on the screen, it's really interesting because
it came up from the same person.
That really,
time, so
okay, good.
Saying,
but it is like super titles in an opera, because I do not like to go to opera without super titles, because I feel so lost all the time. I feel like such an idiot. I feel so, so stupid. And of course, you know, I don't like feeling stupid. So I don't like to go to opera and feel like I've got it, like, you know, run after the dialogue by looking in the dark. You know, with some right. So I just don't. I don't like the feeling. It just feels disempowering. And when there's super titles, I'm present. So I get it. Right. Of course, for many people, for all kinds of reasons, that we do with Shabbat, like putting words up on the screen won't work. But what do we do that's almost like that, or that works in that fashion?
The transliteration in the books.
The transliteration can help. What can help is the rabbi sending out music in advance and translate. Like, what if, you know, now we're all connected to the computer. The rabbi can say, two new tunes are going to be developed over the next 6 months in shul. Here they are. Listen to them on YouTube for, you know, a few minutes each day so that you get familiar.
Can I
Yeah.
One thing that I've seen done.
Yeah.
Maybe we work here, I don't know, is you have a lunch after school. And after lunch, you sit and you learn the new tunes that then everybody's going to use over the next few weeks. And mm-hmm. if you come to lunch, know the tunes next time they come to show, and then can help them go to other people. And they have a nice lunch.
The opportunities for the experience of going to shul to be more than caretaking for our memory, which is really all much, for many people, all it is kind of putting, it's a good way to do a museum service. It basically, honors the museum of Jewish memory. But what would it be like to actually cast this experience into the future as an incredibly exciting, engagement with ourselves, with our families, with the transformative power of Judaism for the world. Like, what is it that Judaism can do to transform us, make us deeper people, richer people, engage our emotions, inspire our mind, and have us responsible more for the world? If that's what the synagogue would do, it would actually be a covenantal institution. Right now, for many of us, the synagogue is at best treading water and at most turning us off. Like, right? And many of us feel turned off. So we run out of time. I want to leave you with one question before you go, and I want you to know I do a session on this topic, and it works remarkably. I don't know if it would work in Britain. It works in the States remarkably. You can try it. And that is, if I would ask you, when in your life, don't think of synagogue, when in your life has prayer worked? You define prayer, you define worked. Prayer can mean all kinds of different things to people, and the moments can be varied, right? Whenever I do this and ask people, when did prayer work for you? People say the most amazing things. And when they share them in community, you learn about your neighbor sitting next to you, things you never knew. All kinds of stories come out. We have a hunger for sharing ourselves really, in ways that the synagogue is often totally inept at doing. How do we find a way to really make this, this environment and this building work to actually carry us the next step on the Jewish journey? I hope this has been at least a beginning of a set of conversations, and thank you very much.